Good morning, everyone. At the moment, we're looking at the shamatha practice, and in the coming days with Renato, you're going to be working with the mind and awareness as objects. So I think at the moment you're still working with the breath, but starting tomorrow, you'll start to work with the mind as the object, and then a little bit later, the awareness practice. So I thought it might be a good idea to talk a little bit more about these practices and then practice them a little bit this morning as well, so you have some sort of preparation for that, so you know better how to do these practices. So what I'd like to do in this session now is explain the first of those two practices, that is observing the mind as the object of shamatha practice, and in the beginning of the next session this morning to look at resting in awareness as the shamatha practice. And to introduce the practice, I'd like to read from Alan Wallace's book, this Attention Revolution, which describes these practices, the ones we're doing. And this practice of observing the mind, remember, he calls it settling the mind in its natural state. So let's see what he says about this practice, and then we'll make some more comments about the practice. It's on page 83 of his book. The object of mindfulness in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state is no longer the subtle sensations of the breath, but the space of the mind and whatever events arise within that space. The object of introspection, as in the earlier practice of mindfulness of breathing, is the quality of the attention with which you are observing the mind. And then he's quoting a text on this practice which says, "At the beginning, have many daily sessions, each of them of brief duration, and focus well in each one. Whenever you meditate, bear in mind the phrase, without distraction and without grasping, and put this into practice." So now he comments, "As you venture into this practice, I would encourage you to memorize these quintessential instructions, which are, settle your mind without distraction and without grasping. Practicing without distraction means not allowing your mind to be carried away by thoughts and sense impressions. Be present here and now, and when thoughts arise pertaining to the past or future or ruminations about the present, don't be abducted by them. As you hike on this trail of shamatha, don't be a hitchhiker, catching a ride with any of the thoughts or images that whiz through your mind. Rather, be like a kestrel hovering motionlessly as it faces the wind, slightly moving its wings and tail feathers to adjust to changes in the currents of the air. Even when your attention is settled in the present, you may still grasp onto the appearances to the mind. Whenever you prefer one mental object over another, whenever you try to control the contents of your mind, and whenever you identify with anything at all, grasping has set in. Here is the challenge at hand. Be attentive to everything that comes up in the mind, but don't grasp onto anything. In this practice, let your mind be like the sky. Whatever moves through it, the sky never reacts. It doesn't stop anything moving through it. It doesn't hold on to anything that's present, nor does it control anything. The sky doesn't prefer rainbows to clouds, butterflies to jet planes. Whatever comes up in the field of awareness, without distraction or grasping, just let it be." So, without grasping, without distraction, just let it be. Which means, in this practice, shamatha practice of observing the mind, the object, again, is the space of the mind and whatever mental events arise in that space, which includes thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images, and so forth. They're part of the object. What's not part of the object is sense objects, sounds, tactile sensations, visual, and so forth. We're not paying attention to those, just mental objects. And in this practice, we're not trying to make the mind still. Whether or not the mind is still or there's lots of activity, doesn't matter. Both equally okay. If there's nothing appearing, observe the stillness. If there's something appearing, observe that. Observe it, arise and pass. Of course, the challenge here is without identifying with it, without grasping onto it and following the thought or the emotional memory or whatever it is. Just observing them, arise and pass. Now, of course, we have the very strong habit of always following our thoughts, emotions and memories. So what you're going to find probably is when something comes up, before you know it, off you go. So again, not to get frustrated that that happens, because that's probably what's going to happen. Because that's our habit that we've developed for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So if you notice that when you're trying to observe, you get swept away, again, as with all the shamatha practices, don't get upset, relax, release grasping onto it and simply return. Let go and come back, let go and come back. And of course, as we saw yesterday, there are enormous benefits with this practice, because if we can really get into this practice and get in the habit of simply observing these mental events, arising, passing, rising, passing, what you will find is that over time your mind will naturally become more quiet and still, and also you'll become the masters of your mind instead of the slaves of your mind. Now, there's one other thing I'd like to mention about the practice before we go into it, is with this practice, it's very much recommended to have the eyes open. Of course, in general, in meditation, the recommendation is to have the eyes slightly open, because if we have them closed, probably get very dull and sleepy. But certainly in this practice, the recommendation is to really is to have the eyes open, either naturally or partially. And there are a number of reasons for that. And again, to just talk about those reasons, I'll read from Alan Wallace's book again. So this is on page 86, and he says the following. And again, he's quoting a text here, a meditation text, and the text says, "Let your gaze be vacant." And now he comments. He says, "In this practice, it is important that your eyes are open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. If you have not meditated with your eyes open, you may find this uncomfortable. But I encourage you to get used to it. Blink as often as you like and don't strain your eyes in any way. Let them be as relaxed as if you were daydreaming with your eyes open. By leaving the eyes open while focusing your attention on the domain of mental events, the artificial barrier between inner and outer begins to dissolve. Especially in our materialist society, we have gotten used to the idea that our thoughts and all other mental events are inside our heads. But this has never been demonstrated scientifically. All that is known in this regard is that mental events are correlated with neural events. But that doesn't necessarily mean they are located in the same place. Even without this materialist assumption that the mind is nothing more than a function of the brain, we naturally have a sense that we are looking out on the world from behind our eyes. But this sense of an independent subject or ego inside the head is an illusion. There is no scientific support for such a belief. And when it is inspected through rigorous contemplative inquiry, this autonomous thinker and observer inside the head is nowhere to be found. In this practice, by leaving your eyes open, but by directing your attention to the mind, this conceptually superimposed demarcation between inner and outer begins to erode. You begin to recognize that your thoughts are not occurring in here in your head, nor are they occurring out there in space. This practice challenges the existence of an absolutely objective space of the physical senses that is absolutely separate from the subjective space of the mind. you are now on a path to realizing the meaning of non-duality. So just to go through again the benefits of having the eyes open. First, of course, is that if you're not used to meditating with your eyes open, you may find this uncomfortable. And that was my experience. When I first started meditating many years ago, I was very agitated. So I found that even having the eyes slightly open, too much agitation. So I started meditating eyes closed. And that helped to reduce agitation a little bit. But then, of course, after some time, just starts sliding into dullness. And then when I was introduced to this practice some years ago, and I first started meditating with eyes open, I really found it quite uncomfortable, because I'm not used to it. But I quickly got used to it. And now, generally, I only meditate with the eyes open. Not only in this practice, but pretty well most practices. And there are a number of advantages. One, of course, is that with the eyes open, and of course here, eyes open, we're not actually looking at anything. But also, we're not straining the eyes. We're not trying to keep them open, so you blink as often as you like. And we're not trying to deliberately unfocus them, because that's straining the eyes. So just naturally resting them in the space in front of you. As Alan Wallace said, a little bit like sometimes what we do when we're daydreaming. You know, we're caught up in a daydream and our eyes are open, but we're not really looking at anything. And the fact that we're not even looking at anything, the visual gaze is still a little bit engaged, even though we're not consciously looking at something. And of course, the visual gaze only happens in the present moment. Therefore, it really, with the eyes open, it really helps to lock us more into the present moment. With the eyes closed, it's much more easy to drift into the past and the future. So that's one benefit. It helps to lock us more in present moment. Also, of course, with the eyes open, letting some light in, it really helps to overcome dullness, so improves clarity of attention. And also, as Alan Wallace said, is with the eyes open, this false sense of inner and outer starts to dissolve. Because with the eyes open or closed, there's really a sense there's a me in here and a world out there. That there's this seems to be really this subject-object duality. With the eyes open, that is not as strong. And so this is going to be very helpful as a transition into the Vipassana practice. Because in the Vipassana practice, which we're about to look at, we're going to realize there is no subject-object duality. There is no independent me, independent world. So if we're already in our shamatha practice, meditating with the eyes open, that can help to break that down even more. So that's going to be very useful. And the other big benefit with having the eyes open in this practice is that we can transition much better to daily life. Because if in this meditation we've gotten used to observing thoughts and emotions and memories with the eyes open, then, of course, in daily life, generally we have our eyes open most of the day, then it's going to be much easier to observe our thoughts, emotions, and memories in daily life, because already we're used to doing that with eyes open in meditation. Whereas if we only do this practice with eyes closed, then we don't have a habit of observing thoughts and emotions and so forth with eyes open. So it'll be more difficult to then transition that into daily life and to do that in daily life. So they are the benefits for doing this practice. Now, of course, here in such an environment, probably not ideal conditions to meditate with your eyes open, because there may be some people in front of you that are moving and so forth, and that will probably attract your attention. Of course, when we're at home, we can control the environment. And often for this sort of practice, it's also recommended to do a little bit the Zen approach. Just have a blank wall in front of you, so there's nothing to attract your attention. And then also you can adjust the lighting. Personally, I like things quite dim. So I have things quite dark. And then, of course, if it's dark and a blank wall, there's really nothing to attract the attention. So that's something you can adjust at home. Here, in this sort of environment, to help avoid the eyes sort of moving around because you're noticing people are moving in front of you, what can be helpful is to pick a point like on the floor in front of you and use that as an anchor point. Again, we're not really focusing on that, but have that as a little bit of an anchor point to help avoid the eyes sort of moving around a lot. So that's some tips what we can do here. So again, either have the eyes naturally open or just partially open, whichever you prefer. So that's the practice we're going to do now. Is there any questions about that practice before we launch into it, about the eyes or what we're doing in the practice? Anything's not clear?
When thoughts arise, what do you mean by follow them? Watch them rise and then fall.
Yeah.
But not follow them. But do you continue the thought and watch it, or do you
yes.
stop it?
So, yeah, good question. Here in the practice, as Alan Wallace said, just let it be. When we're doing the breath practice and a thought comes up, we need to let it go. So we just let go and come back to the breath. Here, we let them be. And let them be means simply watch them as they arise and pass, arise and pass, and not to identify with it or follow it. So what's the difference between observing thoughts and mindfully thinking about something? So let's say we are thinking about this bowl here. Then when we have a thought about the bowl coming up in our mind, if we're mindfully thinking about the bowl, what is the thing we're focusing on? The bowl. Yeah. In this practice, if a thought about the bowl comes up, what are we focusing on? The thought, not the bowl. The thought happens to be about the bowl, but our object that we are focusing on is the thought itself, not the bowl. If we find ourselves focusing on the bowl, we're grasping. We're caught up. That's the difference. And generally, when we get caught up in the object of our thought, that leads to another thought, and then we end up in a story. So if you find that there's some thread, some story unfolding, then there's grasping. If there's no grasping, you'll find that the mental events that come up are very disjointed. There's not really a thread to them. So that's another way to see if there's grasping going on.
And after a long time of training, what do you think or do you observe?
The stillness of your mind.
Is to say no thoughts?
What you'll find if you do this practice well, of course, the goal of this practice is shamatha. And in shamatha, the mind is completely still.
That is to say no thoughts.
No thoughts.
So what?
The stillness of the mind. So remember, the object here is not just thoughts, because if then there's no thoughts, what do? Space out? We observe the space of the mind. Because all these thoughts appear in the mind, don't they? And so that space of the mind where they appear is the object when there's no thoughts. Otherwise, we just sort of space out and then we haven't got an object. So again, the object in this practice is the space of the mind and any mental events that arise in that space. So if there's nothing coming up, if there's no thoughts coming up, just observe that space and look and see what comes up next in that space. Otherwise, we just sort of space out. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, let's do the practice. And this is going to be the practice that you'll start with Renato tomorrow morning for a couple of mornings in a row. We begin by settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. So a vigilant posture is to keep the back nice and straight. And at the same time, allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. Allow your breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And setting your mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. and then allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, keeping the eyes soft and relaxed, blinking as often as you need. And now bring your attention to your own mind and observe your own mind and whatever is arising in the space of the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness, observing them as they arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. If you're new to this practice and you're not sure where to focus, then every now and again, deliberately generate a thought. Any thought will do. And watch that thought as it arises in your mind. And then watch it as it disappears back into your mind. And then keep your attention right where it was, and see what arises next in that space. If you've got caught up in a thought and got carried away, remember the first thing to do is simply relax and then release grasping onto that thought and very gently return to observing the mind. So relax, release and return. Each time you get swept up and carried away by a thought. And if you're finding that you're constantly getting carried away by your thoughts, you might like to experiment with labeling or noting as a way to stabilize your attention. So this means simply give a name to the mental event that arises. So if something comes up, give it a name, like thought, memory, irritation. Give it a name, and that'll help give you some space from that and less likely to get caught up in it. And if you're becoming frustrated at not being able to observe your thoughts, observe that frustration. Whatever's arising, observe it, without grasping, without distraction. Any questions about the practice?
I cannot understand what is the... how I separate the out and the in. You said something about it. I don't know how to express myself. You said something about there is no out and inside. Yes.
Right.
I don't understand how I separate it. I was looking at the reflection of the...
Right, but we're not actually looking at that.
No,
it's only so that the eyes don't move around.
Yes.
What we're observing, of course, is mental events. We're observing thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth. If we have our eyes closed, we really have a sense that that's all happening in here. And that there's a world out there. That there's me in here and world out there. If we have the eyes closed, we have that strong sense. As we're going to see in the Vipassana practice now, coming up today, there is no me in here and world out there. That's an illusion. It's a false sense. So if we have our eyes open, we don't have such a strong sense of me in here, world out there, because it's with the eyes open, there's not that strong difference between me in here and world out there. So having the eyes open can help to break down this false sense of in and out.
So it is only... I don't know how to say it.
Sure. So again, having the eyes open can help us to break down this false sense of me in here and world out there. Because the next stage of the practice is Vipassana.
So it's mentally broken to break?
It's not to break. It's not to... we're not talking about in this... We're not breaking anything in this practice.
Mentally to break it.
Well, in the Vipassana practice, yes. In Vipassana practice, we're coming to realize there's no independent me, independent world. But in this practice, to help as a basis for that, to stop reinforcing the false sense of me, of independent. Because with eyes closed, we really have a strong sense, me in here, world out there. And so we're reinforcing this false sense of duality with the eyes closed. With the eyes open, it's not so strong. We're not breaking anything, but we're just not reinforcing the false idea.
We are not breaking, okay.
No, we're not breaking, but with the eyes open, it helps us to not reinforce duality, that's all. So it's going to be helpful to move into Vipassana.
Thank you.
So I grasped several times, of course.
Only several? Very good.
And I used the technique of labeling.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Right.
But the moment I labeled something, immediately disappeared. So I couldn't...
Very good. Very good.
That was the goal?
No. No. What you'll find is that generally these mental events can only persist if you identify with them, if you grasp on them. If you don't, often they'll just be like this, super fast. Some come up with a bit more force and they'll stay a little bit longer, but particularly the mental events that are not emotionally charged, they'll just be like this, just... So this is very good. Very good.
I thought the goal was to identify the thought and look at it and keep it for a while.
Not to keep it for a while. I mean...
As long as the thought...
Is there. Yes, right. But what you will find is that a thought can only stay there if you feed it. If you're not feeding it, there's nothing to keep it there. It'll just vanish. So if we're not grasping, most of the mental events that come up will be going very quickly, like almost instantly. Now, the most common experience people have in this practice as a beginning point is that they get swept away. You know, something comes up and before they know it, they're gone. So, of course, this is our habit. You know, we've done this since we were this high, always identifying, following. So it'd be completely unrealistic to expect now, if I just sit down, I can start observing them without doing that. That would be completely unrealistic. So we need to understand we've developed a very strong habit for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of following. So it's going to take time to overcome that. So to be patient with ourselves, not to get frustrated when we get swept away, simply go, okay, I got caught away, let go, come back, let go, come back. Keep doing that again and again and again, patiently and persistently. And then over time, we'll start to not get swept up so much. Now, of course, we get swept up, and often it can be minutes later before we realize, oh, hang on, I'm caught up, come back. If we keep doing that, instead of minutes, it may be 30 seconds, 10 seconds, 5 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second. And then we'll notice as we're getting swept up, and then we won't get swept up. So that's the sort of progress. So that's one point. And again, if we get swept up a lot, as you said, one thing that can help at the beginning stage is to give a name to the mental event. But here we need to be careful that we don't just do commentary on commentary on commentary on commentary. So keep it very simple. Just give it a name, like thought, irritation, image, memory. Keep it very simple, and that can help. Another thing that can help if we get swept up a lot is we can begin by anchoring ourselves in the breath, meaning start by mainly focusing on the breath, and you can focus on the abdomen, nostrils, whatever you prefer of the breath meditations. Anchor yourself. So focus mainly on the breath, and then a little bit in the corner of your mind, start noticing thoughts and emotions and memories, a little bit. But main object is still the breath. So that's anchoring. We're holding on to the breath. And then slowly, slowly, start focusing more on the mental events and less on the breath. So you're shifting your focus from mainly the breath now to more and more the mind, less and less the breath, and eventually we can let go of the breath altogether. So that can also help to be able to get into the practice. So that's another little trick you might like to play with. Now, so the most common experience people have is they get swept away. But another very common experience as a beginning point is people sit down and look, and then suddenly there's nothing there. And they think, what's happened? And the most common reason, there are a number of reasons why that happens as a beginning point. The most common reason is that we are coming into this practice with our normal habit of tensing when we focus. Because we know if we don't tense, we're just going to get swept away. So then people come into this practice and tense. And of course that tension is suffocating the mind. There's no space for anything to come up because you're so intense. You're taking up all the bandwidth of the mind. There's no space for anything to come up. So what we need to do then is if we notice that tension, of course, relax. Relax, relax. Relax the tension and then give some space for things to come up. But of course, don't relax too much so that we get swept away. So there's always this balance, you know. And of course, to achieve this balance takes time. It's not something we're going to have right away. So that's what we're doing in the shamatha practice, is getting that balance between relaxation and focus. And of course, another thing that often happens when people sit there and there's nothing coming up, people are going, there's nothing there, there's nothing there, there's nothing there. How come there's nothing there? They're all thoughts, aren't they? So if you have a thought, there's nothing there, that's a thought. Observe it. Or people are trying to watch and they're getting frustrated. Frustration is a mental event. Observe the frustration. Or people get bored. Observe the boredom. These are all mental events, you know. This commentary, frustration, boredom, irritation, these are all mental events. Observe them. Observe them. Whatever's there, observe them. Okay. Just a little bit more comment on this practice and then we'll go back to the text.
May I just one question sure. to this? To observe boredom or any kind of feeling, how to do this? Because it's already there. So let's say I'm frustrated. And then it's there. And then I realize, okay, it's frustration, and then I can go back.
Just observe. I mean, if it's helpful, you can give it a name. You can go, oh, frustration. And then just observe that mental state. See, the thing is, these sorts of mental events are more difficult. Their mental events tend to be either more objective or more subjective. So, like, thoughts, images, memories, they tend to be more objective. Whereas emotions, moods, desires, more subjective, they're more sticky, they're more close. So they're harder to see because we sort of get more subjective. So they have different flavors, but they're still mental events. So if you notice frustration coming up, just look at that frustration. Of course, the key, particularly with these subjective mental events, is to catch them early. Because if they've overwhelmed our mind, if we've become completely agitated, then we're sort of already out of control. It's going to be difficult to observe it. So if we can catch it early, then we can observe it and then it'll pass.
And what do you mean with observe it or look at it?
Just notice it. When you get frustrated, at some point do you know you're frustrated?
Yeah.
Then you're observing it. That's it. Because then frustration becomes an object. See, these mental events like frustration, irritation and anger and stuff, they all come around because there's an object. And if you switch your focus to the frustration itself, you're not focusing, and the frustration's coming, the object is, I can't do this practice well. And that's causing the frustration. But then if you shift your focus to the frustration itself, there's nothing feeding it anymore because you're not focusing on the thing that's causing the frustration. You're just looking at frustration itself. So it can't go anywhere. So you'll find if you can look at it very clearly, it'll just dissipate. But of course, what we don't want to do with these sorts of things is expect or hope that they go away. So remember, in this practice, we are not having any preferences. We're not preferring a still mind over a mind that has a lot of thoughts. Then there's grasping. Whether the mind is still or there's lots of thoughts in this practice does not matter. In fact, in some ways, it's better to have thoughts because then we've got something to watch. If there's no thoughts, there's a great danger of just falling into the really dullness. Whereas if there's thoughts, there's something to really observe. So actually, it could be that thoughts are actually better than stillness, because then we've got actually something to look at. Whereas stillness, again, is a great danger that we just sort of slip into this sort of cozy, spacious, dull state, and we're not really practicing then.
What is about more physical states like being hungry or being sleepy?
Right, so in this practice, sense objects are not the object. So if we have some sort of hunger pains in our stomach, we're not focusing on that. But what often happens, of course, is that a sense object like that or a sound or something provokes a mental event. Like that sensation will provoke maybe, oh, I'm hungry. Then you observe that thought, I'm hungry. Or if a sound comes, we're not focusing on it, but then a thought goes, oh, there's those noisy monkeys again. Then observe that, the thought, there's the noisy monkeys, the noisy dogs. Observe that, but not, we're not paying attention to the sense objects.
And sleepiness, I mean, is it a sense object being sleepy?
Well, again, sleepiness, there will be a corresponding sort of heaviness in the body. But then there will be sort of a mental event of feeling drowsy together with the heaviness in the body. So the mental event of mentally feeling drowsy, we focus on that mental event. So just a little bit more from Alan Wallace about this practice, and then we'll go back to the text. He says, when you first begin the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, you may have difficulty identifying the intangible domain of the mind. Or even if you do settle your awareness there, after some time your attention may become vague, disoriented, or spaced out. If you have difficulty identifying the domain of the mind or sustaining attention there, consciously bring up a thought such as, "What is the mind?" and attend to it. Don't think about this question or try to answer it. Just observe the thought itself, watching it emerge in the field of consciousness and then dissolve back into that space. Once it's gone, keep your focus right where the thought was and see what comes up next. If you slip back into a kind of lax, mindless vacuity, deliberately generate the thought again and observe it with bare attention. When you become familiar with this practice, you will no longer need to generate such a thought, to crystallize your awareness and locate your attention. That will happen by itself as thoughts arise and pass of their own accord. The practice of attending to the space of the mind and whatever events arise there is like taking a naturalist's field trip into the wilderness of your mind. When you first embark on this inward journey, you may perceive very little, but as you grow more accustomed to the practice, you will begin to identify an increasing quantity and range of mental phenomena. Some of them are discrete, like thoughts and images, while others are nebulous, like emotions and moods. This practice provides you with experiential access to a domain that cannot be observed with any of the instruments of modern science or technology. The most they can do is detect the neural and behavioral correlates of the phenomena you are observing directly. You have become a naturalist of the mind, and a whole new world is opening up to you that for most people remains largely unconscious. In this practice, the locus of awareness gradually descends from the superficial level of coarse mental activity that is immediately accessible through introspection, down into the inner recesses of the mind that are normally below the threshold of consciousness. You discover in this training that the border between conscious and unconscious mental events shifts in relation to the degrees of relaxation, stability, and clarity of attention. Especially when you engage in this practice for many hours each day, for days, weeks, or months at a time, you dredge the depths of your own psyche. In doing so, you remember long-forgotten experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, and a wide range of desires and emotions. What happens here is a kind of luminously clear discerning, free association of thoughts, mental images, memories, desires, fantasies, and emotions. You are plumbing the depths of your own mind, undistracted by external diversions. Once hidden phenomena are unmasked through the lack of suppression of whatever comes up. This is potentially an extraordinarily deep kind of therapy, and the more intensively you practice it, the more important it is to proceed under the guidance of an experienced, compassionate teacher. During your meditation sessions, internalize the wisdom of this contemplative tradition, and make sure you implement the core instructions of this practice, which are: whatever arises in the mind, do not be carried away by it, and do not grasp onto or identify with it. Just let it be. Watch thoughts, feelings, or other mental events arise. With discerning intelligence, be aware of their nature, and let them slip back into the space of awareness without any judgment or intervention on your part. This is the key to letting the knots of the psyche unravel themselves as the extraordinary healing capacity of the mind reveals itself. This is the path to deep sanity. Okay. So you'll be starting to practice this with, I think, Renata tomorrow morning for the next few mornings. Okay, let's do a little review now of what we've covered so far in this text before we move on. So here we're following this 7-point mind training text from Geshe Chikawa. And this, of course, is in the 12th century Tibet. And this mind training, or in Tibetan Lojong system of practice, was brought into Tibet through the great Indian master Lama Ratisha. And this comes within what's called the Mahayana vehicle. So in the Mahayana vehicle, remember, the Mahayana vehicle, those systems of teachings that the Buddha taught in the second and third turning of the wheel of Dharma, the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment. And of course, to strive for that goal of enlightenment, we need to cultivate this aspiration of bodhicitta. And in the Mahayana, then the two wings of practice of wisdom and compassion, which also we have in the Theravada, of course, is the wisdom wing in Mahayana is this wisdom of emptiness, coming to realize that nothing exists independently. There's no independent me, no independent objective world. And the compassion wing in the Mahayana is cultivating this aspiration of bodhicitta. And the method that's used in mind training approach to developing bodhicitta is this approach called exchanging self with others, which we're going to be looking at shortly in the text. And this mind training text consists of 57 slogans, 57 very short pith instructions that came, that Tselingpa passed on to Atisha and he brought into Tibet. And it was Geshe Chikawa who then systematized those slogans into these seven groups, these 7 points. And we're using a commentary by one of his main disciples, Se Chilbu, to look at these 57 slogans, these 7 points in 7 points. And what we've looked at so far is the first of the 7 points, which is the preliminaries. And if so, of course, like any system of practice, we need to establish a strong foundation before we go into the main practice. And here the main practices, of course, are emptiness and bodhicitta. And in the preliminaries, what we saw there was that we are to work through what's called, in a systematic way, the practices of the three scopes. These are three levels of ability to make our life meaningful. And we put those main practices together in this form called the four thoughts that turn the mind. This is how they're packaged in the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. And so we went through these four thoughts that turn the mind, these four fundamental preliminary practices that can turn our mind away from chasing after pleasure and happiness out there, turn our mind inward to strive to overcome suffering and find genuine happiness. And the four thoughts, of course, the first one was to reflect on precious human life. The second one was death and impermanence. Then third one, to reflect on karma, to really establish an ethical basis to our practice. And the fourth one, to reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. In other words, to reflect on the first two of the Four Noble Truths, to appreciate that the source of suffering is not out there. Genuine happiness is not out there, it's within ourselves. That the source of our suffering is really our mental afflictions, and if we can work to overcome those mental afflictions, we can find genuine happiness within ourselves. And then, so these preliminary practices, of course, are not just merely something to do as a beginner and then leave them behind, but they are something that we need to continually cultivate. Otherwise, you'll find that that foundation will crumble and we'll have no basis, effective basis, for our emptiness and bodhicitta practice. If we don't keep cultivating these preliminaries, these foundation practices, what you're going to find is that foundation will crumble. You'll start to get lazy when it comes to meditate. You'll get more caught up in chasing after pleasures and I haven't got time to meditate. I've got to do all this stuff here. And then, of course, you'll have no effective basis for practice. So we need to work on them in the beginning part to establish the foundation, and then we need to keep working on them and integrate them into our practice so that we can keep that strong foundation throughout our practice. And then we're now looking at the second of the 7 points, which is training in the two minds of awakening, the mind practice. And so here, mind of awakening is the translation for bodhicitta. And so here it says we need to train in the two bodhicittas. So this two bodhicittas, of course, was conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. So conventional bodhicitta is what we normally think of as bodhicitta, this aspiration for enlightenment, for the welfare of others. And ultimate bodhicitta is the vipassana practice, this wisdom practice coming to realize emptiness. And we're now looking at the first of those is the ultimate bodhicitta, so the wisdom practice. So we're starting by looking at the vipassana practice here, this practice of coming to realize emptiness. And in the beginning part of that, as with any practice, there are two parts. meditation and daily life, what we do in daily life. Because if we only meditate on things a little bit in every morning, and then the rest of the day we run around as we normally do, then that's going to work against the things that we are developing in meditation in the morning. So therefore, we need to continue to work on what we meditate in the morning throughout the day. We need to integrate that into daily life, and then we'll make progress. So the key to progress, of course, is continuity. Not only to have a daily meditation practice, but to continue to cultivate what we meditate in the morning throughout the day. And so here, in this emptiness practice, and also later the bodhicitta practice, we're going to see slogans and instructions on how to do the meditation and then what to do for the rest of the day to continue that practice. And here in the first part, when it talks about the meditation, we saw there that for this meditation on emptiness, but for all meditation practices, of course, we need to prepare ourselves well. So we looked there at these six preparations about, you know, setting up a nice place to meditate, we can make some offerings, and then we go through the process of preparing the body and the mind and so forth for meditation. Very important. If we don't do that, if we just sit down and start meditating, we're not going to have a good basis to meditate. You know, maybe we have aches and pains in the body, our mind is completely distracted and caught up in things. So it's very important to take your time to establish not only a good place to meditate, but to establish the body and the mind, to prepare the body and the mind well at the beginning of a meditation, to put yourself in the optimum point, position in terms of physically and mentally to be able to do the meditation in the best possible way. So that's what we've looked at so far. And in that section there where it talks about preparing ourselves in the meditative session, you know, we see a couple of comments here, like at the bottom of page 3 on the left. With these practices, you enable your body, speech and mind to become a fit vessel for meditative concentration. So here it's talking about shamatha practice. And then it talks about developing the bodhicitta accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. So not only are we to develop a good motivation, the motivation of bodhicitta, but to conjoin that with a very calm, clear and focused mind. And then over on the next top of the next page, it talked about that in our Vipassana practice, we are to investigate phenomena individually to come to see how they exist. And it says, this has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding, i.e. shamatha, to give birth to the shoots of realization. Which means that if we want to come to realize emptiness, if we want to come to a direct realization of emptiness, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. So therefore, whether we're talking about the emptiness practice, the bodhicitta practice, or any other practice, if we want those to really progress and come to the point of a realization of that practice, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. And so that's what we're looking at now. We started to look at that yesterday, and I just want to finish that off this morning before we move on to the Vipassana practice. So we saw there that shamatha itself is a Sanskrit word, of course, often translated as calm abiding, and that's a very literal translation of shamatha, calm abiding. And it's a particular level of concentration we're trying to cultivate in the spiritual path. And it's the one we need if we want to have a stable and clear enough mind to come to directly realize emptiness. And what we saw there was that generally, of course, in this shamatha practice or concentration practice, two qualities we need to develop. Stability, i.e. to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted. But also we need clarity. We want to be able to focus in a clear way. And so those two qualities are overcoming the two main imbalances of dullness and distraction. But we added a third quality there that we all, I think, particularly our modern society, really need to pay attention to. And that is the quality of relaxation. Because we generally have very agitated minds and chaotic minds. And generally in our daily life, whenever we focus on anything, we tense. And so if we bring that tension into meditation, we're going to have all sorts of problems in meditation. In fact, I think the main reason beginners have so much difficulty in meditation is because of tension. Too tight, too tense, pushing too hard. We need to, first thing we need to do in this and any meditation is we need to learn how to relax, have a relaxed body and a relaxed mind. And then on that basis, then we can develop a more stable attention and more clear attention. And then where we saw also in this practice of shamatha is what object to focus on. And of course, the general recommendation is use the object that works best for you. And probably for many of us, that's going to be the breath. And that's the one that's most widely emphasized in most Buddhist traditions. Use the breath as the object. And so that's what you're working with Renato at the moment. And then this morning, what we just did was we looked at the second practice, observing the mind. Again, huge benefits to do this in our modern society because many of us really are the slaves of our mind. We're often tormented by our own mind. And we're often caught up in a lot of obsessive compulsive thinking that really just torments us. Doing this practice, not only is it a shamatha practice and we'll be able to develop a very calm, clear, focused mind, we'll also become the masters of our mind. Our mind will naturally become more quiet and still, and we will not be the slave, but we'll be the master of our mind. So huge benefits in this practice. And then the third object, the one we're going to touch on also in the next session, is this awareness of awareness, or shamatha with no object. It's just resting in the experience of awareness. Again, enormous benefits in our modern society, and I'm going to look at that in the next session. So they're the three objects we're going to be using in this course here. And then we saw that this training of shamatha basically involves overcoming the five faults using the eight antidotes. So we saw in that shamatha chart there at the back of your booklet, that table where we had the five faults and the eight antidotes. And so, of course, the first fault was laziness. And to overcome laziness is really to reflect on the benefits of the practice. Because if we see a lot of benefits into the practice, we're going to have faith in the practice. That's going to lead to aspiration, to effort, and so forth. And then forgetfulness, the fault of forgetfulness, the antidote is mindfulness. Mindfulness, remember here, is our ability to hold the object, to not forget the object. But then we need to monitor that mindfulness, because to monitor if we're falling into dullness or distraction, here called laxity and excitement. So the antidote to that is introspection. So introspection is this quality control, noticing if we're becoming dull or distracted. And then the fourth fault was this non-application, meaning non-application means we've noticed that we've become dull or distracted and we don't do anything about it. That's a problem. So the antidote is application, which means fix it. So generally that just means reapplying mindfulness, reconnect to the object. And then the last one was this over-application, which for us beginners really is not a big problem, but as we get more advanced in the practice, it can become a problem. An over-application means to unnecessarily adjust our focus when it's going actually already quite well. And the antidote there is equanimity, means balance, means the mind is already balanced, leave it as it is. So therefore, by applying these antidotes to these faults, we can progress through these nine stages to shamatha. And that's what I'm going to look at in the next session, is we're going to look at how we progress through these nine stages to shamatha. But now it's time for a morning tea break. So let's take a 30-minute tea break. Come back at 10:45. Remember, there's no gong for this session, so keep an eye on the time. And we'll begin in the next session by this explaining and practicing this awareness of awareness, and then we'll go through these nine stages.